All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the KE Report Weekend Show. I hope everybody enjoyed that first half of the show with Randy Smallwood, really focusing on big picture themes from a major company and a company that provides capital to a lot of more advanced stage companies. But hey, Randy even shared some insights of what he thought on more of the junior market. Now to shift our focus, still within the precious metals and resource sector, but a little bit more towards the smaller junior companies, I am chatting with Matt Geiger, managing partner at MJG Capital. We have Matt on the show pretty much every month to talk about what he's doing within his fund at MJG and how he views the market, what sort of transactions he's looking for within his fund. Matt, it's the end of the year, so what I want to do is take a quick look back in 2024 on some of your best investments, maybe even some of the underperforming ones and some of the key picture themes for 2024, and then transition into 2025. So first things first, let's learn from some of your best and, let's say, not so good investments from 2024. Matt, break down some of the best investments that you had just this year within the fund at MJG Capital, please.
Sure thing, and good to be joining you again, Corey, for last show of the year here. In terms of the names that I've written about and discussed publicly, kind of two names come to mind. The first big winner would be Lara Exploration, ticker LRA on the TSXV. That's up roughly 175% year to date and has really carried a lot of water for the MJG portfolio over the course of the year. I would argue the share price move comes down to two main factors for Lara. The first is on the people front, and it was the appointment of Simon Ingram to the CEO role in January, with Lara's longtime CEO, Miles Thompson, stepping to the executive chairman role. This definitely breathed life into the Lara story. And Simon and Miles have a working relationship that goes back many years. Listeners of your show that remember Reservoir Minerals will remember those two as the leading figures there. And they were behind what was potentially the best discovery of the 2010s. And that was the Čukaru-Peki copper gold porphyry discovery in Serbia, which ultimately sold to Nevsun for $450 million. So it was a big win in what was a tough market at the time. You know, that, of course, has since changed ownerships again to Zijin, and is now in production. And Zijin's actually done a tremendous job bringing that asset online quickly and efficiently. And it's a major mine for them at the moment. So Simon and Miles have a fruitful history working together. And Simon had actually taken a sabbatical post Reservoir days. So this is his first deal post the Reservoir success. And he's really thrown himself into the role. And I think the share price has reacted as a result. And then I said this, the second driver on the Lara front has been developments at its flagship Plan Alto project, which I was able to visit back in mid-2023. This is in Brazil's Carajás mining district. So right in the heart of the Brazil mining scene, this is where Vale grew up and became the major company that it is today. I will say that Lara received a huge streak of fortune. This was in late 2023. When the keys to Plan Alto were handed back to the company by their former JV partner, Plan Alto, who was focused more on their later stage projects in Chile and had spent $10 million of their own money on Plan Alto, only to hand the keys back to Lara when copper was closer to 360 or 370 per pound. And then in addition to that, Lara has come out more recently with a maiden resource at Plan Alto, which I think really surprised, at least judging by the share price reaction, really surprised the market to the upside in terms of the size there, over 200 million tons of open pittable resources there. So this is not a tier one deposit in terms of scale, but Plan Alto's advantages in terms of location near hungry mills and near existing infrastructure, its permittability, metallurgy, there's a real lot going for this project, and I think it's going to make it into production much faster than many anticipate. So I'm expecting Lara to ultimately sell Plan Alto. I don't think they'll take this into production. We could see a transaction within the next 12 or 18 months, and I wouldn't be surprised for the price to be well in excess of Lara's current market capitalization. And then, of course, there's a whole lot more to the Lara story with assets in Brazil and Peru. And Miles Thompson's primarily taking the lead on the rest of the Lara portfolio with Simon driving forward things at Plan Alto. So I think the company is really well situated as we head into 2025.
What do you think of those other projects in South America then? Because look, Lara is a Prospect Gena royalty company. One project is, I believe, back in production. Another project was sold this year. What do you like in terms of the rest of that portfolio outside of Plan Alto?
Yeah, well, there's a lot in there, and it's a true sum of the parts story. I mean, I would argue there's two other assets that are worth paying attention to. One of them is an asset called Liberdade, which is a copper IOCG deposit also in Brazil. I would argue it's geologically more prospective than Plan Alto even. The issue there is that it's been caught up in litigation for years. We're getting on close to a decade now of litigation between who was Lara's partner at the project and then Vale. So a resolution there, and it's very difficult to handicap. There will be an end to this litigation at some point here, and that would put a shock into the Lara share price overnight when that occurs. So that's one asset that, you know, one could argue at Lara's, you know, 60, 70 odd million market capitalization could be a company maker right there, you know, when it's freed from the shackles of the ongoing legal battle. The second is a phosphate asset in Peru, which in the previous market cycle received a $50 million valuation when it was part of Stonegate Agricom. So Lara's quietly working behind the scenes there, getting local communities on side. And really, I think situating that for either a sale, a partner to come in, or maybe even potentially a spin out. So I would say amongst the rest of the Lara portfolio, those are the two other assets to pay particular attention to. But there's a lot more going on within the portfolio.
Okay. Yeah, I always find it encouraging too when share prices moving higher are driven by actual news events, and that resource from Plan Alp in a way kind of re-rated the stock. But hey, there's a lot more going on there. What's that other investment you're going to share with us from this year?
Oh yeah, it's a name that you know quite well. It's Kenderland Minerals, and that's one that we've written about in recent investor letters. I know the CEO Zach Flood there comes on the KE report quite often, and he does an excellent job really sharing the Kenderland story with the market and keeping investors abreast on the company's progress there. You know, I'd argue the driver for KLD's performance this year, you know, stems from that fantastic deal announced all the way back in January, where they swapped their 20% project level stake in the Frotet project, which I was also able to visit last year. That was in the fall of last year. Swapped that with the majority owner there, Sumitomo, where Sumi assumed 100% ownership and Kenderland received a 4%, a really healthy 4% NSR on the project, with a limited buy down to 3.25%. So I think the re-rate we've seen this year has been the market really slowly understanding that the value of the Frotet royalty alone really dwarfed Kenderland's enterprise value, with the rest of the company's operations coming for free. And even at the company's more elevated share price today, you know, whether we're at, you know, somewhere between $1.15 and $1.20 per share, you know, simple back of the envelope math, just looking at the amount of money that Sumitomo needs to buy down that 0.75% royalty, and then applying that to the residual 3.25%, the residual value almost perfectly covers Kenderland's current enterprise value. Once you factor in it's, you know, $27 million in working capital, and then, you know, $3 or $4 odd million in marketable securities. So I'm still very optimistic on the future of Kenderland, you know, with at least four of their projects, Frotet, Shibistawan, Hunter, and South Uchi as well, set to be drilled by partners next year. I think you can make a very good argument that cash, marketable securities, and the Frotet royalty aside, all else comes for free.
What do you think of the strategy too that Kenderland has undertaken, where they're creating royalties on some of these early on stages? This is a prospect generator, but they're already getting on that trend of creating a royalty, keeping it in a subsidiary, and still looking for partners.
Yeah, I think it's smart. I mean, I would still classify Kenderland as a prospect generator, but I would say within the prospect generator business model, there are kind of two trains of thought. I think Kenderland are going about it the right way. You know, one train of thought is to keep a project level interest, and the other is to prioritize a royalty. So Kenderland is taking more of the EMX route, so to speak, where they care less about the project level interest and are prioritizing the royalty over all else. And I think that makes sense because the royalty is a financial instrument, you know, within the metals and mining space. It seemingly gains attractiveness every single year. And that's been a phenomenon that we've seen play out over the past couple decades.
Okay, so a couple prospect generators transitioning to royalty companies that did well this year that you're invested in. What about some of the underperforming investments or investment that didn't work out for the fund, at least this year?
Sure. Well, a name I've written about publicly that has not gone our way this year, quite admittedly, is Bravo Mining. Bravo remains one of our larger holdings within the portfolio, and it's a name that we were fortunate enough to invest pre-IPO stage. So it has been a large winner for us since our initial investment back in 2022, but it's been a really rough year for the company. I will say I've been surprised by the extent of the share price weakness. We have talked about Bravo on previous discussions on the KE report. And you'll remember spring of this year, I think it was late May, the company announced out of the blue that they had made a new discovery at their T5 target, hitting 11 meters of 15% copper equivalent mineralization of IOCG mineralization. First time that IOCG mineralization had ever been encountered on the company's land package there at Luanga. And in short order, that saw the company's share price re-rate from, you know, 223 share price all the way up to close to 450 per share on the back of that stunning result, which really came out of the blue. With that said, in the ensuing months, it's become clear that the T5 target itself does not have, you know, sufficient tonnage to really justify a standalone operation. Or if it is standalone, it's not large enough to get the market too exciting. But the reality is we've seen the share price retreat all the way from north of four, you know, well below $2 per share at this point. And so if you look back, again, Bravo was trading at 223 upon the announcement of that IOCG discovery. So I think one could argue that you're receiving zero value at this point for any IOCG mineralization on the entire land package. And I think that's ultimately a mistake. You know, 11 meters of that grade of copper equivalent does not come out of nowhere. And so, you know, it hasn't come together as quickly as the market would have liked, clearly. But I think this team has, you know, the resources with over $20 million in the bank and a very accomplished technical team with previous IOCG experience in the Carajás district itself to really flesh this out and figure out where the source of that mineralization is. So for the time being, Bravo is in the penalty box. And I think the market's looking for them to kind of solve this IOCG puzzle before the story is reignited again. So it's a bit of a waiting game there. But again, the saving grace is they have, you know, really healthy working capital position that's going to allow them to flesh out this thesis as we go into 2025. But undoubtedly, that position has weighed heavily on the portfolio, you know, over the course of this year, you know, down close to 35 or 40% year to date.
So Matt, would your strategy here be to cost average down in Bravo, or are you simply still in this kind of wait and see period, all taking into consideration that it does sound like they need to do a lot more work here?
Yes, fair question. Given the existing size of the position, we're in the wait and see mode. I mean, Bravo is close, a double digit, you know, weighting within the portfolio as is. If it was a smaller weighting within the portfolio, kind of, you know, 5% or less, we'd certainly be looking to double down at its current juncture. And again, I really need to emphasize the significance of its working capital position. If I knew the company needed to raise money in the foreseeable future, then the game plan would be to sit on our hands and, you know, wait to participate in the financing. But they did such a good job of raising large sums of capital when the market was cooperating in 2023 in particular, that they've set themselves up. Even though expiration hasn't gone as quickly as folks would have liked, they set themselves up for, you know, over a year of runway and significant work before they'd even need to consider coming back to market for more capital.
Let's stick to that financing point just a little bit more, tie that into 2024 and also M&A, because look, we did see a lot of money raised in the sector. However, the argument being that it went into generally a fewer number of companies. And also M&A, man, there was a lot of mergers and acquisitions this year, really focused on the higher quality, more developed assets, even those already in production. But we did also start to see some mergers between some of the smaller junior companies. These two themes of 2024, what do they mean to you?
Yeah, well, we've discussed ad nauseum in recent podcasts, just the M&A mania that we have seen really over the past 4 to 5 months. And I think the last time that we had a discussion, you know, I highlighted five different deals where between them, we're talking $22 or $23 billion worth of value changing hands there. So this is substantial and, you know, the most M&A that we've seen in probably over a decade. And I would say the pace of that M&A has, you know, simply continued since our last discussion. I mean, here we are in mid-December. Just this month, right at the beginning of December, we had Northern Star all-share offer for De Grey Mining in Australia for its, you know, Tier 1 Hemi Gold project in WA for $5 billion. So that is very chunky. You know, that adds to our total and gets us closer to $30 billion just between six different deals there. That was a nice 37%. Premium being paid by Northern Star, acquisition to close, you know, likely in the spring of next year. So that's a very notable deal that maybe some in the North American, you know, markets missed. We've also had Newmont continue with its non-core asset disposal process. And we've seen Cripple Creek sold this month to SSR Mining. That's only $100 million upfront, but the, you know, total price tag there could rise up to $275 million U.S. pending various regulatory approvals. And that's, you know, fast on the heels of Newmont also monetizing its Eleanor mine in Quebec, you know, for roughly $800 million in cash. That was in late November. And then in mid-November, they sold Musselwhite for a similar sum. I think that was roughly $850 million. That was to Orla Mining. So fortunately for the sector, Newmont is nearly through its asset disposal process. I know Coffee may still be on the chopping block and maybe there are one or two other assets, but you know their process is largely complete by this point. And then just this week, we had Lundin's sale of its Neves-Corvo and Zinkgruvan mines, both in Europe, to Boliden. That's $1.5 billion. So that's not a deal to sneeze at by any means. This positions Lundin much more as a copper-focused and South American-focused operator. Hopefully, it's a win for both projects. Those are both pretty decent assets, make a lot of sense for Boliden, both from a commodity and a jurisdictional perspective. So hopefully, a win for both groups there. And then very recently, we had Agnico Eagle finally make a move for O3 Mining. This was a deal that was many years in the works, and I think Agnico found an opportunistic time to pounce. You know, that's a smaller deal at maybe $200 million, give or take, you know, taking O3 off the board. So really the M&A activity that we've discussed just continues apace. And I think it's a really interesting question to see if it continues into the new year. My anticipation is it does.
Yeah, I'm with you. I feel like this M&A is going to continue, but who knows? These are the kind of things that can turn on a dime. However, that environment still looks very promising for, again, the higher quality companies, projects, and also the ones that make sense beside other major mines or major assets. Let's move to 2025. Key themes in 2025. What is on your radar early on, Matt?
Well, in no particular order, and I would say these are more unanswered questions than anything. But these questions that are playing on my mind, one is on the precious metals front. You know, 2024 was very much a story of central bank buying and investment demands, you know, X the Western world. You know, so the question is, you know, come 2025, do Western institutional and even retail investors, you know, warm to the precious metal story? So that remains to be seen. My inclination is probably not yet. That might be more of a 2026 story. You know, and I think precious metals have come so far and in such a short period of time, that wouldn't be a bad thing to see some consolidation. And, you know, I think when the Western world does warm to precious metals en masse, that will supply the next upleg within the bull market. But that's one open question. The second, you know, in previous years, in recent memory, where we've seen precious metals really rip, you know, you can think back to 2016, you can think back to 2020, I'd say 2024 is a similar year in that respect. The following year, we've seen spillover into the broader metals complex. So, you know, the open question here is, does this repeat where in, you know, 2025, it's more of a year that's favorable to metals like copper and, you know, other industrial metals, or maybe even some life returns to the battery materials and energy metals like lithium and nickel. You know, my gut says this is quite possible that history will repeat, but the jury's still very much out on this front. Another question that comes to mind, and you know, we just touched on this, is does the M&A boom that we've seen over the past 4 to 5 months, you know, continue unabated into the new year? My inclination is yes, but that also remains to be seen. And on a related note, and this is of particular interest to the MJG partnership, do we finally see some consolidation within the junior royalty space, you know, which is quite crowded, you know, with sub 500 million market cap names, you know, EMX, Gold Royalty, Elemental, Metalla, Vox, you know, these names come to mind. You know, personally, I do think we do see some M&A activity, at least a deal, if not a couple, amongst you know, this peer group of companies. Though to be fair, I've been saying that this would be the case for 6 to 9 months, and it's been cricket so far. So that's another open question for the new year. And then I would just say from a broader market perspective, you know, can we have an orderly rotation, you know, out of cryptocurrencies, you know, out of high-flying tech companies like the NVIDIAs and the Palantirs of the world, and really out of the overpriced, you know, U.S. market more generally, you know, into underloved spaces like natural resources, like cyclicals more generally, you know, like stock markets ex the United States, you know, or does this rotation have to be precipitated by a crisis? You know, recent history will say it usually is precipitated by a crisis. So that's probably the direction that I would lean. But again, this is another open question. You know, these are all things that are playing on my mind as we head into the new year.
I think all great questions and all big picture themes for this sector that could really dictate if this bull market continues or if it does start to roll over. But also that money spill over into some of the other metals. So much seems to have gotten concentrated into especially gold and gold stocks this year. Matt, what about jurisdictions? Look, these are always variable, especially in South America, but also around the world. Some jurisdictions get hot, sometimes for multiple years, sometimes just for 1 or 2 years. What jurisdictions right now are you a little bit more cautious on that the market seems to really like?
That is a good question. Okay, so one that comes to mind, and this might upset some listeners, but it's the Ivory Coast, which is, I would argue, the hottest mining jurisdiction in Africa at the moment. I mean, you have groups there like Montage Gold or Awale, both listed on the TSXV. And on the ASX, names like, you know, WIA Gold, Turaco, African Gold, you know, these are stocks that are up, you know, 2 to 3x, if not more, year to date. So some incredible performance. And there's been a lot of money flowing into the Ivory Coast, a lot of drilling activity. Like it truly is a hot and happening jurisdiction at the moment. And for good reason, incredible geological endowment. And it's a stable and, you know, accessible place to explore at the moment. So it's exciting to see. You know, my concern, and I think the question is whether it can remain immune really to the extreme political instability and the jihadi violence that we're seeing to the north in the African Sahel. And we're also seeing that spill into some other parts of West Africa, though not the Ivory Coast at the moment. I mean, heck, since 2020, in the general region, we've seen 9 successful coups. And my understanding is we've seen at least as many unsuccessful coups over that same period. We've seen jihadi violence increase by 140%, according to recent figures, since 2020, and millions of people displaced as a result. So, you know, can the Ivory Coast continue to defy gravity and really avoid a lot of these issues that are plaguing its neighbors? I think that's a key question. I'm hopeful that the Ivory Coast can resist these forces, you know, both for the sake of its people, as well as the MJG having some portfolio exposure to the country as it stands. But I think it's something that investors and companies operating in the country should be, you know, paying attention to see if this continues. So that's one area of potential concern. I'd say a second jurisdiction, and I definitely wouldn't describe it as a high-flying jurisdiction like the Ivory Coast, but another jurisdiction I'd flag is Peru. The current president there, Dina Boluarte, she's a stand-in for former president Pedro Castillo, who you remember was thrown in jail in late 2022 for attempting what, you know, has been described as an auto coup basically trying to usurp power from the legislature there. She's a stand-in, immensely unpopular. She has a 4% approval rating. Like, I don't think I've seen anything like it. Literally a 4% approval rating. Less than 1 in 20 people approve of her performance in office. And meanwhile, the Peruvian Congress there really is blatantly and transparently corrupt. And their approval rating, according to recent figures, is not much higher than Boluarte's herself. So in Peru, we're still a good ways off from the next election. My understanding is it's scheduled for spring of 2026. So we'll say we're roughly 15 months away. But the concern that I'd have is whether the citizenry there is just so fed up with the status quo and may vote for a burn the house down candidate who's not friendly to Western mining interests. So it's hard to say at this point which candidates will emerge as the front runners. I think we'll have a better sense probably towards the middle of 2025, which candidates start getting some traction and the degree to which foreign investors, should be concerned. So we also have some exposure to Peru through the aforementioned Lara expiration. So this is also a situation that I'll be following closely as we head into the new year.
All right, Matt, final question then. As we talked about the potential rotation of some money from precious metals into other metals, what metals do you like that are maybe a little bit more under the radar or haven't performed as well in 2024, now looking into 2025?
Now you're putting me on the spot, Corey. And
bet.
And you know that when I evaluate new investments, I really do try to de-emphasize the metal of focus and look much more at bottom-up fundamentals, whether it's the people involved, the asset assuming spot metal prices, the company structure, upcoming catalyst, yada, yada. With that said, one metal that, has piqued my interest for a few years here, and frankly, we've never had exposure to, is the metal tin. There are very few investable vehicles that are out there. And I would love to come across a tin vehicle with the right people behind it, a good-looking asset in an investable jurisdiction, and back a company focused on tin from an earlier stage. I've been looking for a few years and haven't come across the right opportunities, so we remain tinless within the MJG portfolio. Perhaps I should just bite the bullet and buy Alphamin, which is an exceptional deposit, the Bissi deposit, located in a very unsavory part of a tricky jurisdiction, which is the DRC. So that's another, viable avenue for tin exposure. But I do think tin is interesting given its irreplaceable role in semiconductors. And I've been a bit surprised we haven't seen more of a grasping of tin's role in kind of the AI revolution and the continued push there, and more generalists, stream into the tin space. I think that is something that we could see in 2025 or 2026. So the metal does seem potentially meme-worthy for me. It has received, a good amount of attention. I'd say an outsized amount of attention within the mining investment community. But I've yet to kind of see that spill over to generalists more broadly. So that's one metal I'd flag as we head into the new year.
All right, Matt, great having you on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure and honor to chat with you on pretty much a monthly basis. And I really appreciate how you have broken down some of the investments that you have within the MJG portfolio and just how you're viewing these markets. This weekend show, I think, has been a very unique one, hearing from one of the largest company executives in the resource sector, as well as an active fund manager in the resource sector. Please, everyone, take note of what these guys are saying and what they are looking forward to in 2025. Again, Matt Geiger, managing partner at MJG Capital. Matt, thanks for joining us on this weekend show. And everyone, thanks for tuning in. I hope you all have a very happy holiday season. A Merry Christmas to everybody. Next week, we will be a bit shorter with the daily editorials, but be sure to check the website and podcast for a few more company and market updates. Matt, everybody, again, thanks for tuning in. Have a great rest of your weekend.
The Corlin Economics Report is produced for A.B. Corlin and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.